Oh my gosh, okay.
So what have you got there?
This is actually an index card typed in an old-fashioned typeface. It's got my name and a date of birth. At the top right-hand corner it says coloured child. And then in red it's got Midlands Division.
Resilience, a life in care. A personal podcast series by Tony Simpson.
Admitted admissions was that date.
Which was?
The 14th of the 10th, 1961. And then from the 29th of August, 1967, I went to Wildmoor Road in Shirley, Solihull, which is where I sort of grew up. And then, that's interesting, so on the 6th of the 1st, 1978, my case was closed. Not much of a life really on one piece of card, is it?
I think it's quite a remarkable document. This is your life on a single card with four entries.
No, it is a remarkable document, yeah. But I did have a sense of belonging, so I'm actually down as a permanent, which I know within Barnardo's, bizarrely enough, is quite rare. A lot of kids in Barnardo's were actually in there for, you know, a period of 4, 5, 6 years. Being a permanent is a bit like having a life sentence. You sort of have a different mindset. But I was one of the permanents.
Episode 2.
Hello, I'm Tony, and welcome to the second episode of my podcast series about my life in care. Although I have a successful career as a business consultant, the legacy of a childhood spent in care has never left me. It shaped me in good ways as well as bad. I now feel it's time to confront this part of my life and to come to terms with it, which is why, in the first episode, I went with my friend, radio producer Paul, to where it all began. I was born here.
Oh, you were born here?
Yes, in the mother and baby home, Salvation Army.
In this building here?
In this building. My first breath on planet Earth was here.
Wow.
It was from this Salvation Army home in Birmingham that my mother and I were separated when I was just 3 months old and she barely 16. It would have been a morning, I guess, my mother would have been waiting for her parents to take me to Oxford and drop me off and then have to go home on her own. I can't even comprehend what that would have must have been like. But this was a window. This would have been the view. Jeez. That's pretty sobering, isn't it? That early part of my life, my birth in a Salvation Army home, the journey my grandparents and their children took from Jamaica to Birmingham as part of the Windrush migration, and my mother and I going our separate ways, are all explored in the first part of this podcast series. In this episode, I want to go back to where I had my happiest childhood memories, back to the Barnardo's home that I lived in until I was 6. I want to find out how accurate those memories are and how much they're informed by the few photos that I still have of my time there. But before we do that, Paul and I need to go to East London, where Barnardo's keep their archives, including all the paperwork they have on me. In many ways, it's a sort of, I would say not a weekly, but at least a monthly breakdown of my time in care, which is quite extraordinary. Everything from, you know, when I first contracted measles to walked, or every school report I ever had. So that's all in there. It's quite interesting. So I was quite excited today, but also I think I've slightly disassociated, to be really honest. And there are things on there that I've discovered, you know, my relationship with my parents is written down there in black and white. I can read it, but I haven't actually ingested it. Much of this paperwork I already have, but seeing it neatly compiled in an inch-thick stack of paper is oddly unnerving. And the information it contains, once I go through it, is both blunt and inconsistent.
The whole thing was light and heavy, that there would be elements of my reports where they'd be saying I was way behind, I could barely read or write, and, you know, I had no motivation. And then the next paragraph said I was a wonderful poet, very intelligent, hugely creative, and actually my work was on the wall. So I was having to read my life through somebody else's expectations for me, which is the tough bit, actually, because when I started, I was saying it was a factual record. It's not actually a factual record. It's an interpretation from the 1960s of what a young black child in care is going to be or should be. And the expectations for me on there are pretty limited, really.
Are you happy you've got this now? Or are you viewing this inch-thick pile with some trepidation?
It's an interesting question, actually. Part of me wants to take it home and just bury it in the garden. I just want to run away from it. Each element in there I've seen before, but actually none of it is in one place in my house. I've never ever kept it in one record because I've never really wanted to view it as one record because I probably wanted to deny that journey, I guess, and that pain. And I think that's tough.
I mean, I'm wondering if this exercise is almost going to be too painful.
Yeah, it's going to be really painful, actually. But I think it's going to be even more painful for me not to do it for my overall happiness. It'll be really tough, actually.
My reason for doing this series is to give something back, to do something more than just supporting the work of charities like Kids Company and Barnardo's. I hope that by confronting my past and honestly sharing my experiences in care, those that are on a similar journey, those currently in care, or coping with the legacies of care, might see that such experiences can be used as a tool to bring about positive change.
The more you talk about it and the more you can confront your past, you can learn to live in a much freer way. And doing this allows me to understand why I'm always worried about things. And, you know, I look at my family and my children, they just don't have that heaviness that I have. And they have the freedom to not be terrified every day. I remember years ago when I was working with Kids Company, and one of the girls there, I just said to her, you know, oh, I feel sad saying this, really. I said, just see, no, it never gets better. She listened to me and she said, you know, you're the first person to just talk to me. I said, it never gets better, but I promise you, there are ways through it. I mean, you can't live a life like this and not be affected. But I'm doing it because I'm just tired of seeing clever kids, kids with no hope and sadness.
Take the third exit onto Marcham Road towards Marcham.
Marcham, that's where we're going. That is where we're going, Marcham.
Marcham is in Oxfordshire, 2 miles west of Abingdon, and the nearest village to Oakley House, the home that I was sent to after my mother and I went our separate ways in October 1961. She to living with her parents, and me to the care of Barnardo's.
It's funny, I wouldn't have thought I grew up in the countryside, but I did. Look at all this.
This is not how you remember it.
To be honest, I don't remember life outside the wall. I know there were journeys to and from school, or, you know, we wouldn't have gone out shopping or to the local town, I guess. We were just, you know, we were in the home. And that was our world, really. And this is it on the right, I think.
Is this the first time you've been back since you were six?
Yeah. So? Look at that. This is it. Look. And now we're going up the drive into Oakley House, and on my right is the metal wrought iron fence that was there when I was there, actually.
Paul and I are here to meet Michael Jorin, who runs Stowhill Estates, the agents that are selling flats in what was once my home.
Michael.
Yes.
Where shall I park? Here. Thank you.
Gosh, I'm a bit nervous and shy, but I'm sure we'll be fine, Paul.
Shall I take the file with me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's only one flat still available in the property, and Michael has kindly agreed to show us around.
We didn't want to just walk in. Paul and I were saying, gosh, how could we get access to have a look at it? Because we're doing a podcast series on, you know, journey through care. Yeah. My journey through care. And it really started here. This is the first home I was in.
So how long ago was it you were here?
50 years ago.
Wow.
I was in this side of the house, actually, down at the bottom over there.
On the ground floor?
Yeah.
Well, that's apartment one.
Yeah, that's where I was.
So you're about to go in.
I thought so. I've got photos. I'll show you a picture of me outside it in a bit.
Yeah. You ready to come and look?
Yeah, let's go and have a look. Yeah.
I first came to these doors when I was 3 months old, when the history of the building was irrelevant to me. Much of that history I've learned since, going through the documents I've recovered from Barnardo's.
Oakley House had been an old stately home, and after the Second World War, it had been a convalescence home for British troops, And then after that, the family never moved in and they bequeathed it to Bernardo's in the 50s. And then I ended up going in the 60s. Now, of course, it's luxurious apartments and flats. Oakley House review. So this is one of the things we need to, I guess, discuss. So this is basically my admittance forms to where we are now, to Oakley House. So it's the bridge from Salvation Army to Bernardo's. It's funny how the Salvation Army described my grandparents as wonderfully homely folks who've just moved into a small three-bedroom house, spotlessly clean, neatly furnished. And the letter goes on to talk about that the grandmother was in confinement herself, meaning she was pregnant, and so they'd hoped that at some stage I'd be able to rejoin the family. So actually, when this application went in, it wasn't, I don't think, with the view that I'd be there for as long as I was. I guess the bit that stands out for me is I'm described as a really beautiful child, and no doubt at all that the mother is very fond of it. It's got my name, and as usual, in brackets, coloured. Oh dear, not my race defined me early on, because you wouldn't have guessed that if you'd have seen me, I guess. I wonder why that code was put on all the time. It would have been an irrelevance. You wouldn't have had John Phillips in bracket Jewish every time you put his name there, or Jim Jones in brackets Catholic. But I don't think there's a single document that doesn't have Anthony Frederick Simpson in bracket coloured. So I shut the door?
Yeah, if you want to, yeah.
I presume that's the original door, yeah?
I think so, yes. Now, I doubt this is an original staircase.
No, I don't think it is.
Because it wouldn't have gone right next to the window there. No. But some of these are the original walls here, wow. Because you've got an archway, so it would have been a corridor coming along here.
Yeah, wow.
Do you have a clear memory of the house?
It was a bit back to front. So the stately home itself had steps going down into the gardens, and either side of the steps were three or four big windows, which opened up actually as doors into the garden. But this was actually the back of the house. The front of the house was on a gravel drive, which faced away from the road. And I don't remember ever going out there. I was on the ground floor to the left as you looked at the house. And we lived in, now I guess there'd be dormitories. And I guess there would have been 5 to 6 beds in there, in each dormitory. And it's all we knew, you know, on long tables. And that was just our life.
Can you remember who was in your dormitory?
I can't say names now, it'd be inappropriate, but I can remember, yeah, I remember children. I remember being particularly protective towards one young boy. I remember there's a couple of brothers who were very sporty. I always used to try and out sprint. They later became professional footballers. Yeah, I do remember. I do remember it all. Gosh. Do you know, I probably slept. That is so weird. The younger children would have been on the top.
Okay.
Because they weren't going in and out all the time. And I remember at that end, they were young, but I was here. I was actually here. I must have slept in here, actually, bizarrely enough, because these wouldn't have been clearly apartments.
No.
We'd have all slept in and around here.
When we talked about it, you talked about it as a very happy time for you.
Yeah, it was.
A sense of security, I think, that you...
Well, it was, because it's, if you think about it, this building, as is now, was an island on its own, you know. All of my education, I learned to walk here, talk. Every skill of being a human being I got, as in neurological or physical, was learnt here, within Nursey State. So, you know, Paul was saying when I came back, how do you feel? I didn't know what to feel, really. You know, it's not like, oh, gosh, I'm sad or anything. It's just like...
Chapter in your life, isn't it?
Well, you have to process it, really, as well. I've got vivid memories of Oakley House, actually. It's entwined, actually, with a Swallows and Amazon childhood, actually. It was not an unhappy time, you know. There was lots of children there. There was no sense in those days of race or class. So I was just there with lots of children who were, I'd say probably, this is astonishing to look back on, I think 40% of the children there were black or mixed race. And it's the only time I've ever lived with black or mixed race children, actually. I didn't even notice until I saw photos at a later date. There was countryside around. And there was a lot of, I genuinely believe there's a lot of love and affection there. Oakley House wasn't Oliver Twist, gruel, anybody being abused or anything like that. The problem is, you see, kids were coming in there at such a young age that they had no sense of loss. You just survive, you know? Your sense of loss comes after that. I remember actually the affection we'd get from the staff there as well.
And who were the staff?
I remember I used to get postcards from the Sunning Hill aunties. So we'd get postcards from old people's homes and women in old people's homes who would mix up with us. We also used to get a lot of students working in the summer, young girls working there. But there'd be the matrons who would probably be, you know, oldish women who were quite officious. But there was always a mixture of people coming and going. And I think it's where I learnt to have to just stand out and try and grab attention by being funny or whatever. You know, my reports at the time say that I played to the gallery.
We should have a look at what these reports say. It does say, actually, I think I need to read this one out. It says, very alert and friendly because of his quite enchanting looks. He is inclined to get more than his fair share of attention from visitors and a very nice person, dash, affectionate, which is nice. I don't think I've changed much, apart from perhaps not as affectionate now, but I've certainly still got the looks and I'm enchanting. But interesting enough, there's a student here who's 3 months called Betty Acton, who paid attention, and also Mrs. Alexander, who I think I remember, actually. I think she lived in Abingdon.
What I don't remember, having looked at my memories, is my parents or anyone from my family ever coming to visit me. And yet when I look at the documentation that I had from the archives in Barnardo's, they'll say that for the first couple of years, or years 3, 4, 5, 6, that my grandparents came or my mother came, or a combination of both. I don't have a single memory of that, which is interesting. Yeah, I remember all of the other stuff.
Oh, it says mother visited and
other relations,
28th of the 12th, 61. And the reason that's quite interesting is that's 28th of December, so it's in between Christmas and New Year. I tried to work out how long it would take to get here from central Birmingham, and I worked out it was a 3.5-hour journey on public transport, where they'd probably have to get a bus from where they lived into central Birmingham, go to Digbeth's coach station, get a coach to Oxford, and then get a local bus to Frilford Heath, and there and back in one day would have been six hours of the day. So I can see where they might have got fatigued in coming to see me. It's been quite tough, quite an ordeal, actually.
These are your annual reports, aren't they? Because last one was 1962.
In fact, yeah, you're right. So three times again in 63, my mother have visited, yes. So she's still a miss there, so she hasn't got married there. And then 64, three times again. So here's another report. This is 65's. Now it talks about family contact and mother's contact being erratic, extremely erratic, and promises to visit not materialising.
No, actually, promised to have him for the summer holiday, but it didn't materialise.
Gosh, that's funny. It's funny, I didn't even read that, Paul. Yeah, I wouldn't read that. That's weird. Yeah. I don't think I can read this writing. Genuinely, can you read that?
Developing well,
yeah.
But a trying little boy.
Yeah.
Very much in the clouds at times, e.g. always has shoes on the wrong feet, jumper inside out, and so on. Affectionate.
A proper and accurate reading of these papers, something I've avoided doing in the past, means that many of my memories are incomplete. You remember what you want to remember, and what doesn't remind you of the disappointments and unreliable promises. And the most vivid memories rely heavily on a few prized possessions. In my case, 3 black and white photos from Oakley House. A group of us boys in the garden in front of a sandpit. Me at the back of the house near the stairs and doorway. And me in front of the marble fireplace with a large Christmas tree. Photos I'm keen to show Michael and find the places they were taken. So here's me at Oakley House and one of the fireplaces there.
Wow.
Is there a big fireplace in the middle somewhere? Was there one?
If you went through that wall,
yeah.
That's flat 2 sitting room where there's another fireplace. It's quite a large one.
Is it a marble one in there?
Yeah.
It's that one. Because they wouldn't have put a Christmas tree here. They'd have put it in the middle of the house next to the big fireplace.
Yeah.
And if you look at it again, it's a marble one. You can see it's marble.
I don't think next door are in, unfortunately.
Oh. No, don't worry. And actually, that's me outside here.
Yeah. That might be next door steps.
Yeah, but that looks like an end there.
Oh, yeah.
It looks like here.
Oh, you're right, actually.
It's this one.
Gee, you're right.
Yeah, it was here.
Yeah.
I was stood. I've got to try and get a sense of where that picture was. Hang on. One, two. That's right. You can see the end of that there.
Yeah.
I mean, were they all happy?
No, I don't think so. Anyone who came from a parent's house wouldn't have been happy. And some of them, you know, would have been inner city kids whose parents couldn't look after them. Or some of the kids there actually were oldest or youngest of siblings and they were taken into care while mothers had babies. So they were missing their mothers and they would have been crying for the mothers and stuff like that. So when I say I was happy, I think underneath all of it was a grey seepingness on either side of my eyes that I knew was there. You know, a dark foreboding was always there. Nobody ever tucked us in. I think at that age, you know, if I'd have, well, I did, it happened to me, you know. I remember once I cut my leg open, my natural instinct was to run behind a tree and rub my leg, not run to anyone, because what's the point? And I think none of us would have cried ourselves to sleep. You'd probably done it for the first 6 months, and then it was like, why bother? So if I think about it in those terms, we were all very independent emotionally. Most of the children spent most of the day sprinting up and down, having running races around here. But I suppose if you're six, this is quite a big place. You know, I do remember that.
And your memories while you were here are of that older age group?
Yeah, not the smaller ones, or the older ones. Yeah.
So your images that you might have in your head, presumably a lot of them are influenced by the photos you have, but the images you have in your head, you are generally six.
Yeah. I can't remember being young, learning to walk, anything like that. Yeah, I'm not a baby. I think when I was in Oakley House, there were two options. One was what they called BO, which means boarded out, whether I was going to be boarded out or adopted.
Boarding out is what? Fostered?
Yeah. What tended to happen was most of the white kids got fostered and adopted, which is why when I say there were lots of black kids there, we just ended up being the residue, really, and there were lots of us there. So when we moved on to the bigger homes, proportionately there were more of the black kids who went. 50% over six went. No, it was never even conceived for me. And in fact, I've got a photo of me at Oakley House, and I'll describe it, actually. There we go. There's quite a few. This one, I'm actually in the gardens. I can show you there. Every single child there is black. There's four children in the photo, all under six, and we're all black. I'm the good-looking one on the right.
Obviously. Oh, I got you. Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought that straight away.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's there, actually. It's still there. So I'm probably stood. I'm telling you where we are, Sandpit's here, where Paul is standing now. No, it's quite extraordinary being here in the garden. I wouldn't have known because we wouldn't have had a concept of what race was. So I know there are children of colour there because I've seen photos of myself in the gardens with them and I can remember them, but no more did I think X was any different to Y. They were just curly brown hair. But it's interesting, in 1964, I've been there 3 years, and every year you'd have a social history development report and it says he's fully Jamaican. Yeah, really. Talks a bit about my family and the reason why I was there. It's rounded off. Anthony is coal black in colour, very negroid in looks and speech, which is quite interesting because I guess I'd have been three and I don't know what my speech would have been like, but if I was very negroid in speech, I must have been very advanced to not only be able to speak, but also speak with a negroid accent. Wow, very good. So it says more about the person writing this than myself. And this report, of course, would have gone through to Bernardo's head office and catalogued with everybody else. So, no, there wasn't racism as such. It could have been institutionalised, but I wouldn't have known what an institution was. I didn't see it. You know, all of that was to come. I'm still keen to find the fireplace in the photo of me at the age of five, taken at Christmas. And so is Michael. So much so that he soon has me peering through the windows of flat two.
Yeah, that does look like it.
Stand on the chair.
I don't want to break it. My gosh, it does look like it. We won't break it, will it?
I don't know. You break it, you buy it.
You can tell he's a salesman. You break it, you buy it. I didn't even blink when you said that. Yeah, that's it.
Another one.
Oh, my God. Absolutely bang on.
Oh.
That's it.
Hello.
I'm so sorry.
Oh, sorry.
Embarrassingly, the neighbour is in, but not too shocked to find me perched on a garden chair looking into her living room.
And I've got a photo of me in front of your fireplace.
Seriously? Yeah. This is so lovely.
In fact, once Michael explains why we are here and what we're doing, Melinda invites us in to have a proper look.
So when I was little, this is me. These are me here, actually. So that's me in the garden.
Oh, my gosh.
Onto the other
one.
Yes,
yes, of course.
And then that's me in here. That's your fireplace.
Oh, my gosh, what is? So do you feel it's changed much?
Yeah, I've probably changed a bit more than the building, actually. I think the building and I have changed together, really. Mm-hmm. We've aged gracefully. It's odd coming back that it feels like I'm working in a film set in a weird, weird way. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's interesting, but I haven't really processed it because it's impossible to process while you're here. It's important for me. I know I'll go back and think, gosh, I have definitely stood in this room before, and I'll have to go back and think about that. Gosh, there were sad and good times, you know, here as well, you know. A lot of children had a tough time in this place as well, you know. So walls could talk. But it was generally a happy place, you know. It wasn't miserable. I used to think I was Peter Pan, actually. I used to think that this was my gang, and I was feral. And grown-ups were something else, and we were all there. It's really interesting. When I saw the film Hook, the one with Robin Williams, for me, it was crushing. I was in bits watching it. It just took me back to there. The world they went to was my world, and I knew it so well. And I think for many children growing up in care, those first 6 or 7 years aren't that devastating. It's what happens after that, where there's no safety net. You need real resilience to deal with the rejection or losing that environment. That's when you need your resilience. Otherwise, it's very bad for people's mental health. No, this would have been a loud, squawky place with children running around. And you see, I don't remember the front of the house because it was where all the serious stuff went on. You know,
yes,
the grown-ups
yes,
were.
Yes, of course.
But the back was our world. In fact, I remember outside more than inside. But, you know, we slept here. But the sad thing about a place like this is we were lucky in as much that there were a lot of young girls who worked in the local colleges, I think, and here looking after the children. But there were no parents, so it was an institution still, and it was very efficient. And as an efficient house, it was quite nice.
Those of you who weren't adopted, that wasn't felt as that you were second best?
No, not at all. In fact, I probably would have hated being adopted because I was at home. For me to be adopted at that age would have been the same as anybody else listening to this being taken from their parents' house before they were six and to live anywhere else. You'd think, what the hell? It would have been horrible. So I was probably delighted I wasn't adopted, actually.
I wish Pollyanna was here. She'll talk about some of the trees actually having small toys embedded in them. So they've obviously been planted, wow. And, you know, these things have been embedded. And, oh, wow. You know, the tree is growing and up. There's a little motor car.
Oh, my God, I'm glad to see that. I'd have been in bits.
And I wish I knew where that was so you could see it.
But is it here somewhere?
Yes, it's still here. So she keeps saying, I'll go and show you it. But it might be you won't find it without her help, and she's not here at the moment, but it's one of those big trees with a small car embedded into the wood.
It's a metaphor, really, isn't it?
It is a bit.
There's everything carried on. Beautiful. It's still there.
Oh, yes. Oh, gosh.
Has anybody else ever been back? Am I the only person?
I couldn't tell you. Don't know.
It's
try and get a reunion.
Oh, God, no. No, it doesn't quite work like that. It's very hard to have a friend from there because people's experience and journeys were so dramatically different. It's very hard. I'm not in touch with anybody who I lived with in care. And in fact, if I was, it would be just them away from people who weren't in that environment because it's a shared understanding that people would find very hard. As you and I have this conversation, I can give a narrative of what it was like then, but if I was talking to somebody who I grew up with then at the time, I would be able to tune into what they're thinking and why they're saying it. It would be a different conversation, actually. The memories I have of my time here in and around Oakley House are generally happy ones, but they are also tinged with a sense of foreboding, of freedom being taken away, and of Peter Pan finally having to grow up. I think Oakley House saved me in many ways. It gave me a stability
and a piece that I probably wouldn't have got anywhere else. It sounds a bit melodramatic, but I felt safe and free of fear. When I look back at it, I think I was free of fear. My first resonance of fear were when I was 5 and a half. The realisation suddenly dawned on me that this wasn't going to be forever.
So in 66, yeah, my mother's got married. So my mother's agreed that actually it might be quite good to look for a foster home for me. She's unable to look after me at that stage. Oh, okay, recommendations. So 1966, there was a recommendation to stop at Oakley House for another year and then should be moved to another branch home where his mother could be encouraged to visit, basically. Interesting.
It's terrible, but it's true. You know, they called me in one time and said, you know, you'll be leaving next year. They sat down and told me, I remember it. They said, you'll be leaving next year and you'll be going to Warwick, children's home there, with 3 or 4 of the other kids there. So for the next 6 months, I think I probably braved it out. Oh, my God, what the hell's Warwick? And the word was just a word. But then I knew I was going with other people, and between us, and I say between us, bearing in mind we're 5 and a half, 6, with no parents, it's just us, are trying to think, oh, it's going to be great, and whatever this Warwick thing is. And then I think about a month before, I was told I wasn't going. I was going to Birmingham, and everyone else was still going to Warwick. I remember thinking, what? And at that stage, I've never thought about this before, I probably felt massive betrayal. I'm sure I was terrified. You've been listening to Resilience, A Life in Care. In the next episode, Paul and I will be in Birmingham, at the children's home that would house me until my 16th birthday, and where my education in survival really started. I can feel it now as I think about it. So I can remember the car journey going from Oxford to Birmingham, because I went through Banbury, and somebody pointing out in the car that that's Banbury Cross from the nursery rhyme, and trying to jump on anything that seemed familiar. And then it's like the lights go out. I can't remember anything from my first couple of years in Birmingham. It was just very traumatic to go from an environment where it was like it was in colour to a council estate in South Birmingham where I was the only black face. And it was alien. It was just culturally alien. And I went straight to the local school as well, where I gave up on education, I think. I just had to survive, yeah. That was tough.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode. The series is part of our wider oral history project, in which we capture and share the incredible experiences of the Windrush generation and their descendants. If you enjoyed it, a rating and a review would really help us. For more information on the project and to learn more about Tony, please visit the Oral History Project website at www.barnardos.org.uk/oralhistory. Thank you.